Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Fight to Flight. Littered with failures and successes, Precision Hawk charts course for relevance in drone business. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Drones are rising, but where will this land? And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. From a nondescript office off North Raleigh's Six Forks Road, the buzz of flying machines can be heard in the hallways at Precision Hawk. Michael Chasen, its newly tapped CEO, stands with a remote control at the ready. A drone with whirring propellers and clicking cameras rises over a carpeted space that used to house cubicles, soon to be ripped out. The lease runs out at the end of the year. By that point, the 60 employees currently working out of the space could increase as the industry, after 7 years' worth of expectations, starts to take shape. Chasen knows the stakes. He is playing in an industry that, while headline-inducing, has yet to reach the potential outlined by its early visionaries. It's an enticing proposition, as PricewaterhouseCoopers recently put the value of the global market for drone-powered business solutions at more than $127 billion. But that's if you survive. Most companies are still struggling with what exactly their business models are going to look like, points out Missy Cummings, the director of the Humans and Autonomy Lab at Duke University. Early casualties of that struggle may outnumber the successes in recent months. Take GoPro, which made its own high-profile debut in the industry, only to recall its Karma drone after a power glitch caused units to drop out of the sky. And 3D Robotics, once a leading player in the consumer space, dropped its manufacturing division entirely last year to focus on services. French drone maker Parrot disclosed it was cutting one-third of its staff, or nearly 300 people. And even Chinese firm DJI, the leader in the consumer space, has been making cuts. But Chasen says Precision Hawk has a different vision entirely. Its focus isn't the device flying through the sky, but on the sensors and the data they're collecting. And big-name players such as Intel and Verizon have banked $30 million in venture dollars on Precision Hawk's ability to sell the result. Serial entrepreneur Bob Young, one of the firm's first backers, says the time is now. Young, who co-founded Red Hat, says Precision Hawk is about to slough off the startup status and scale. That is why he has tapped former Blackboard CEO Chasen late last year, a man with a history of scaling tiny startups into industry disruptors. A variety of applications. Precision Hawk sees drones as more than just a crop duster replacement. While agriculture is its primary target right now, Young sees multiple industries applying and profiting from the technology. With drones, tasks in a variety of industries prove safer and cheaper, he says, and the data backs up his ideas. For example, a standard wind turbine inspection costs around $1,500 per tower. But according to 2016 PwC estimates, performing the same task with a drone could cut the cost by around 50%. And similar savings could be achieved on other activities, such as bridge and tunnel inspections, where additional safety concerns push the cost even higher when using human labor. A drone equipped with the right sensors and software could provide data for construction crews on precise work, such as steel slab positioning and pipeline depth, all information that could, proponents say, prevent costly and dangerous construction errors. Amazon, which has already deployed its Amazon Prime Air overseas, wants to automate the last mile delivery of packages using drones. Right now, a 4.5-pound package shipped about 6 miles costs Amazon between $2 and $8. According to that same PwC report, a drone reduces it to just 10 cents. A farmer needing Precision Hawk's help, for example, could buy a crop scouting package for about $2,000, which includes both the drone and software to back it up. Farmers with between 500 and 1,000 acres can deploy that package to check on the vegetative health of their fields. With the package, he can fly each field in an hour, says Precision Hawk's Leah Reich, vice president of marketing. With each field averaging about 160 acres, it's a time saver. Typically, to scout that field on foot, it would have taken him an entire afternoon, she says. The issue for Precision Hawk and others in the drone industry is that regulation still isn't keeping up with industry demand. Even after officially allowing limited commercial activity in the space last year, the Federal Aviation Administration has heavy restrictions on commercial drone use. FAA Administrator Michael Huerta called regulations released in August the first step. We are taking a careful and deliberate approach that balances the need to deploy this new technology with the FAA's mission to protect public safety, he said last year. But regulations are just one of the challenges grounding companies trying to take advantage of the technology. A challenging business. While it has yet to take off, the drone industry is already a competitive space, particularly with hobby drones. On a recent earnings call, Charles Prober, Senior Vice President of Software and Services at GoPro, talked analysts through the challenges. His firm debuted, then almost immediately recalled its first drone last year. That product, Karma, just re-entered the market but is still meeting skepticism from analysts. We are wary of GoPro's ability to succeed in the drone space, wrote CFRA research analyst Angelo Zeno in a recent investor note. Prober points to numbers from the research firm NPD that show drones were the highest growth consumer electronics category, up 143% year over year, as GoPro's motivation for sticking it out. But he notes many of his peer companies have exited the drone business. This demonstrates the challenges of establishing a branch, finding distribution, and investing the capital to fund development of competitive, differentiated products, Prober said on an earnings call this month. Chasen says Precision Hawk stands out because it, unlike companies putting out hobbyist quadcopters, isn't targeting consumers. For Precision Hawk, it's not just about the aircraft itself, but what its software can do and predict. The drone itself doesn't help Monsanto or Shell or DuPont, he says. The drone just gives you a flying computer machine. You have to put the sensors on it, you have to put the software in it, and you have to stitch it all together. That's why Precision Hawk is putting less emphasis on the costly hardware and more of its energy in software analytics. Instead of developing the latest, greatest drone from a hardware standpoint, it's putting emphasis on the less costly algorithms. Precision Hawk, Chasen says, can equip that aerial robot with the scientific tools to analyze thousands of acres and determine exactly where a farmer should target with its pesticide. It can see precisely where moisture issues exist. Its software can calculate how much corn a farmer can count on harvesting next month. Through analytics and open source software, Precision Hawk is researching how far those tools can be applied in multiple industries, from agriculture to oil and gas. Precision Hawk services go across the gambit, he says. They can range from $10,000 to $500,000 for companies looking to deploy Precision Hawk software, devices, and pilots. While the company declines to talk about actual bookings and revenue stream, online research outfit Hoover's estimates the company's annual intake could be as much as $15 million. No slowdown in funding. While Precision Hawk may have the open source advantage in its chairman Young, it's not the only company eyeing drones as data tools. California-based AeroVironment, for example, is already a top supplier of drones for the Pentagon and counts giant companies such as Lockheed Martin as partners. The firm, which inked $71.3 million in drone revenue alone in the first half of its fiscal year, recently unveiled what its executives are calling the first and only end-to-end commercial drone information solution. And it, like Precision Hawk, is targeting analytics in the agriculture space. Like our military customers, commercial customers need real-time access to specific information in order to make better decisions, AeroVironment CEO Wahid Nawabi said on a recent earnings call. More innovation is coming as investors line up to back the new industry. In 2016, investors poured $424 million into 93 deals funding drone technology, according to CB Insights. While that's less than the $475 million they funded in 2015, it's more than 12 times the $33 million investors funneled into the industry in 2012, and shows investor interest is far from waning. Last year alone brought $30 million to drone maker Airwave and $25 million each to manufacturers Skydio and Zipline International. Precision Hawk's 2016 Series C round topped at $18 million. Still, Dukes Cummings says she'd put Precision Hawk at the top of the stack when it comes to the quality of its commercial drones today. It's just premature to get a handle on what will succeed in the new industry. It's so early that there's no stable business model yet that I've seen, she says. CFRA Zeno characterizes the drone industry as years of really high expectations resulting in disappointment. While he points to traction in the consumer space, he blames the regulatory environment as the primary reason the devices haven't really taken off in the commercial space. I just don't think the FAA has become comfortable enough with the safety of these vehicles, he says. There are just significant limitations. Ready for the long haul. Those include rules prohibiting nighttime flying and operating drones outside of a pilot's sight line. But the same regulatory barrier could work toward Precision Hawk's benefit, as it has actually partnered with the FAA to resolve safety issues. As Precision Hawk engineers continue to innovate in its testing labs, many of its researchers are outside, working side by side with academics and government officials to figure out the guidelines. In addition to working with the FAA to craft the rules it released last year for drones, it has been researching beyond line of sight flying. It's a severe limitation if, like Amazon, you dream of having the device deliver packages someday. Precision Hawk's research led it to obtaining the first FAA exemption to fly beyond the sight, beyond line of sight last year, and it has been working to establish training criteria so that other companies can obtain their own exemptions. It's also working on what's being called LATAS Lattice, an automated traffic control system to keep drones out of commercial airplanes' flight paths. Aided by its own research, Precision Hawk has obtained broader permissions to fly than its peers, at least in the United States, and that's led to major lines of revenue in what's being called flying as a service. Basically, since Precision Hawk has an exemption, its pilots can fly drones for companies that do not. Since obtaining that permission in August, revenue has more than doubled, says Young. He equates the FAA's recently released regulations and exemption opportunities as flipping the switch on the entire industry. Before that, all big customers were very limited in their use of drones because they knew the FAA was not yet willing to let people fly drones for commercial use, Young says. But now, everything is happening. For Precision Hawk, it means transitioning from an engineering research firm to a scaling entity. More and more companies are deploying Precision Hawk technology and contracting with Precision Hawk pilots both for training and device deployment. Customer growth is why Young pushed to hire Chasen, who has a history of creating industries where they don't exist. Chasen pushed for online learning tools when venture capitalists said universities would never sign on for something like that. For drones, the stakes keep getting higher, and not just for Precision Hawk, which as of last year counts Verizon Communications, USAA, and Yamaha Motors as financial backers. A high-profile collision with a commercial airplane or a hacker weaponizing a fleet of quadcopters are just two of the nightmare scenarios that could derail the industry in its tracks. CFRA Zeno said that could absolutely have a major impact on the space and clearly the regulatory environment. Young says that's just one of the reasons the company is working with the FAA to develop the technology to avoid an industry-squashing incident. And its success would prove good for Raleigh, where Precision Hawk, armed with money it raised last year, is targeting significant growth in 2017. Despite Chasen's D.C. background and the company's Canadian founders, he says the company is in Raleigh for the long haul. Here's where the tech talent is, he says. The pieces are there. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, Band Together lands big act for Y benefit. A Raleigh organization that uses music to foster social change is confident it has a hit this year, with a concert expected to attract thousands and a project that could have a major impact on Southeast Raleigh. Ben Folds will be the headline act when Band Together holds its headline event May 6 at Red Hat Amphitheater. We're pumped, says Band Together executive director Matt Strickland, who has coveted Folds for several years. Band Together picks a nonprofit each year and is working to help the YMCA of the Triangle this year. Band Together hopes to raise more than $1 million for the YMCA Beacon site planned for Southeast Raleigh. The $15 million facility, scheduled to open in fall 2019, will be built in conjunction with a Wake County Public Elementary School, affordable housing, and commercial projects. The project is being built on 32 acres at the intersection of the Beltline and Rock Quarry Road. We could not be more excited about having Ben Folds as the headliner for an event that will benefit our community in such an impactful way, says Doug McMillan, chief executive officer of the YMCA of the Triangle. It's going to be great music for a great cause. Band Together's fundraising prowess has soared ever since it began in the wake of the September 11 attacks, and a small group of people in the Triangle wanted to use music as a vehicle to make a difference. The effort has been a colossal success, with a swarm of volunteers supporting two full-time employees. The past 2 years, Band Together has raised more than $1 million for its charity. Our goal is to raise $1 million year in and year out for our partnerships, Strickland says. Hey, we want some of that special sauce for a Big Mac. Tony Delegati, a McDonald's owner-operator in the Triad and grandson of Big Mac creator Jim Delegati, was in Raleigh February 8 to help bring attention to a charity program that's near and dear to his family's heart, the Ronald McDonald Houses of Durham and Wake Counties. Delegati was on hand to auction off one of his last bottles of the Big Mac special sauce that the chain had produced as a special giveaway in January. McDonald's had produced only 10,000 bottles, and dozens of the bottles have since hit the collector's market on eBay. Recent Buy It Now offers have ranged from $100 to $100,000. G. Patel bags top award from Restaurant Group. Congratulations to Raleigh restaurateur Gaurav G. Patel, who was honored February 6 by the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association as the Restaurateur of the Year. Patel, 33, received the award in an event at the Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill. I'm truly honored, says Patel, founder and president of Echelon Experiences. There are so many other restaurateurs and restaurant groups doing great jobs. Patel has been in the industry 15 years. He says he tries to share his experiences with others who want to move up in the restaurant world. I try to be an open resource. I try not to tell people what to do. I try to share my experience, he says. Every person has their own path to take. Shortening the errors they are making is something I try to do. Patel says the company's 6 restaurants focus on being of service to the community as well. Cool guitar draws big price. Looked like the local executives from the Triangle were in a giving mood during the annual North Carolina CEO Forum recently. At the event's dinner soiree, MedFusion's Steve Malik, currently known as Triangle's soccer czar, and McGraw-Hill's Diane Adams auctioned off a dazzling Paul Reed Smith Standard 22 guitar signed by The Who's Pete Townsend and Roger Daltrey. To make it even more interesting, Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder signed on as well with Joan Jett. Bidding for the guitar was quite robust, eventually selling for $9,500 to Sue White, chair of the board of advisors for Duke Cancer Institute and president of Donathan Properties in Greensboro. White plans to donate the guitar to the folks at Teen Cancer America so the nonprofit group can showcase the piece when TCA expands its facility in Durham. With First Citizen CEO Frank Holding Jr. sitting in front, along with Capital Investment Company's Richard Bryant, former Quintile CEO Tom Pike, and EDM America CEO Scott Byers, among many others, the mood was happy and clearly generous. Sampling West Coast wines for a great cause. The annual Triangle Wine Experience has come and gone with another all-star grand gala that raised money for the Frankie Lemon School and Development Center in Raleigh. The event was held on February 4 inside the vacated Field & Stream store in Cary. People sipped West Coast wines from California, Oregon, and Washington State and sampled food from local restaurants. Seen in the crowd were Richard Holcomb and Jamie Dement of Coon Rock Farms, Linda Kraft of Linda Kraft and Team Realtors, former Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina CEO Bob Gretchen, Recent TBJ Family Business Award winner, Taylor Cash of Taylor's Wine Shop, and Governor Roy Cooper. As far as the wineries involved, some of Biz's favorites came from Lando, Moffitt, Crocker & Star, Domaine Della, and Reynolds Family Winery. During the silent and live auctions, thousands of dollars were raised to help boost funding and enrollment of the school's children. Beach Town, contractors squabble over airport deal. For owners of Ocean Isle Beach properties, Biz believes this story may be of interest. A years-long conflict over the Ocean Isle Beach Airport continues as a state appeals judge has sided with an aviation company over the town that hired it to manage the airport. The town of Ocean Isle Beach claimed contractor Jackson Hill Aviation violated its ordinances by not having the airport staff during business hours. So they, according to court documents, changed the locks on the facilities. Jackson Hill Aviation sued. The town asked the judge to dismiss the lawsuit entirely. When a court sided with the town, Jackson Hill Aviation appealed. The Court of Appeals reversed the dismissal February 7. Town Administrator Daisy Ivey said, "This issue will be discussed with our attorney and board during the February board meeting." According to the North Carolina Department of Transportation, Odell Williamson Municipal Airport has a total estimated economic impact to its community of $3.3 million. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Retail Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, many new hotels targeting downtown Raleigh still months, even years away. For years, tourism boosters for downtown Raleigh have pleaded for more hotel rooms to support business travel downtown and group activity at the Raleigh Convention Center. And over the past few months, developers have submitted plans that could nearly double the downtown district's inventory of 1,127 rooms. But it could be as late as mid-2018 before construction could start on any of the new projects beyond the one hotel opening in 2017. The new 10-story Residence Inn Raleigh downtown that opens on Salisbury Street in May. The delay in new construction, though, isn't for lack of want, developers say. Some have other projects in other markets that are ahead of schedule in front of the downtown projects, and it's a financing and timing issue. Others are being delayed by the franchise brands that want to control when new hotels are opening in certain markets. One of the projects on the agenda for the Raleigh Appearance Commission on February 2 was the proposed 12-story Courtyard by Marriott Hotel at 431 South McDowell Street. Amit Patel, president of Wynwood Hospitality of Raleigh and developer of the proposed hotel, says his team is pretty far along with its plans for the $30 million building, but he still doesn't expect to break ground until fall 2018. We have three other projects slated to start prior to Courtyard Raleigh downtown, he says. Wynwood is planning a new Courtyard Hotel in West Cary near the Parkside Town Commons Retail Center and a dual hotel concept at Briar Creek in Northwest Raleigh. Updated renderings for the proposed Courtyard Hotel on McDowell Street show a tiered 12-story building with 192 guest rooms and suites, plus a street-level bar and cafe, an elevated lobby and pool area above structured parking. The site is currently a single-story building leased to Enterprise Rent-A-Car. The other downtown hotel project on the Appearance Commission's agenda was the proposed dual Hilton Garden Inn and Homewood Suites Hotels at 200 West Davie Street. The developer of that project is CN Hotels Incorporated of Greensboro. Architectural drawings submitted for the Davie Street project show a 13-story building with 259 total rooms. A representative of CN Hotels did not respond to a request for comment on the project, which was approved with conditions. Another high-end project planned includes an Element Hotel at 603 South Wilmington Street that's not expected to open until 2020, according to the hotel's website. The developers of the City Center mixed-use project planned at 301 Hillsborough Street and the developer of the proposed 2 Glenwood mixed-use building at 607 West Morgan Street have also proposed a hotel as part of their projects, but neither have disclosed the hotel name or brand. Raleigh developer to break ground on new Fresh Market in Holly Springs. The developer of the proposed The Fresh Market anchored retail center in Holly Springs confirms that construction should be breaking ground within the next week, and the first store is opening by early 2018. Nick Brown, half of the father and son team at DNN Development of Raleigh, confirms that they have closed on the purchase of the 6.4 acres of land next to the Harris Teeter and Sunset Lake Commons Shopping Center on Sunset Lake Road in Holly Springs. A subsidiary of DNN paid nearly $2.1 million for the property they're calling Holly Lakes, according to county records. The seller was Chatham Street Investments of Cary. The Fresh Market will anchor the 52,831 square foot center, and Brown confirms he has a lease contract pending with the owners of Town Hall Burger and Beer of Durham, which will be taking the center's lone restaurant space. Other tenants include Pet Supermarket, Hand in Stone, and Lee Spa Nail Salon. Document details Cary Mall's plan to lure IKEA to 15-acre spot. The big Swedish home furnishings giant that has been rumored for months to be bringing a big box store to the Triangle still has confirmed nothing about a specific place or time, but the owners of Cary Town Center Mall are doing everything they can to stack the cards in their favor of landing IKEA. Tennessee-based CBL and Associates Properties, which has owned Cary Town Center since 2001, in December proactively refinanced the $46.7 million loan balance that was coming due in March on the 928,000-square-foot mall property. CBL executives have hinted that redevelopment plans are underway, but the first tangible proof the mall owners are targeting IKEA was recently disclosed via the mall's new loan agreement with Prudential Insurance Company of America. It was in an exhibit labeled IKEA Release Parcel, and attached to the 71-page document was a grainy site plan highlighting a subdividing of about one-third of the mall property. The parcel includes nearly all of the former Sears and Macy's department store boxes and adjacent parking lots that total about 15 acres. That would be relatively small compared to other IKEA land deals, which typically range from 25 to 35 acres for a 290,000 to 345,000 square foot store. But sources say IKEA is considering a plan with two levels of shopping and showroom space and underground parking. IKEA's closest stores are Charlotte and the Washington suburb of Woodbridge, Virginia. IKEA spokesman Joseph Roth has said the Triangle is a market that long-term can support a store. Wake County documents filed in December also show CBL officially terminated its more than 20-year lease contract with Sears. Sears vacated its anchor store at Cary Town Center in 2014. CBL, in early 2016, also took ownership of the former Macy's department store. Maryland firm looking to make a big push into the Triangle pays $10 million for Raleigh land. Caruso Homes, a Maryland home building company that has been working behind the scenes to make a big splash into the Triangle's lucrative housing market for the past couple of years, is about ready to step up to the diving board. The building company in late January paid $10 million toward the purchase of 215 acres of undeveloped land on Lake Wheeler Road near the historic Yates Mill County Park and NC State University's 1,500-acre field laboratory for agriculture research. Caruso Homes is planning to build up to 155 single-family homes on the land for a new subdivision called Old Mill Trace. Homes will be priced in the 400,000s. The builder is also expected to break ground in the fall on the first phase of its massive 1,038-unit Collins Ridge development project in Hillsboro. And in a section called By the Numbers, even while adding nearly 2,800 new apartment units over the past 6 months, the Triangle's vacancy rate for apartments in the region remained a steady 6.1% in the second half of 2016, according to the semi-annual Apartment Index report by Charlotte-based Real Data. And as for now, it's looking like increasing demand for apartment units in the Triangle is expected to keep up and even exceed all the new construction still ongoing across the region. The Triangle had 5,894 units under construction as of late January when Real Data survey was conducted. Angle Addington, a multifamily analyst for Real Data's apartment index surveys in North Carolina and Virginia, points out that even the submarkets were with higher than average construction levels, such as downtown Raleigh, are keeping pace. Downtown Raleigh had an average vacancy rate of 7.5% in January, with 1,700 units under construction. So vacancy rates could approach 10% in downtown Raleigh in the next year, but that's still not too shabby for that much new construction in one area, Addington says. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "The pent-up demand in Pittsburgh has far exceeded anything we could have imagined when we started putting this property together." And that's from Tim Smith, developer of the 7,000-acre Chatham Park in Pittsburgh, which is expected to start construction this year on its first retail and mixed-use development buildings, a new Thales Academy school campus, at least three more office buildings, and its first residential neighborhood. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Life Sciences page written by Jennifer Henderson. The main headline, Raleigh firm adds healthcare expertise. Roughly 7 months after adding a pair of seasoned healthcare partners from Smith, Moore, Leatherwood, Nelson, Mullins, Riley, and Scarborough, has added two more to its Raleigh roster. Antonia Peck and Aaron Roberts have joined their former colleagues, Robert Wilson Jr., previously the managing partner of Smith, Moore, Leatherwood's Raleigh office, and Patricia Marcus at Nelson Mullins. Nelson Mullins has 25 lawyers in Raleigh, with 7 in its healthcare practice. Nelson Mullins, based in Columbia, South Carolina, is growing its healthcare practice locally and also added Ashley Thomas, an associate in the Indianapolis office of national healthcare firm Hall Render in September. Noah Huffstedler, the fourth managing partner of the Raleigh office, says, "We can take care of 90% of a client's needs with people whose expertise is located right here in Raleigh or Winston-Salem, without having to call on support from the firm's offices in South Carolina, Nashville, Tennessee, or Atlanta. This is particularly important given a healthcare industry that is changing rapidly," says Wilson, "given uncertainties surrounding the Affordable Care Act." In terms of healthcare clients involved in mergers and acquisitions, Wilson says the Raleigh practice has between 7 to 12 transactions pending, with more on the way. As for clients who have made the move from Smith, Moore, Leatherwood alongside the four recent laterals, Wilson says, "Client retention has been virtually 100% in our moves, unless there was a conflict that could not be resolved. About 50 of Nelson Mullins' more than 500 lawyers practice in traditional health care, according to Huffstedler. Marcus says that Nelson Mullins' corporate bench and focus on technology were both draws in her making the move last summer alongside Wilson, with whom she has worked for 2 decades. Both Peck and Roberts say that Nelson Mullins' size and resources were attractive in joining the firm, as was linking back with their former colleagues. Raleigh is a real area of strategic focus for our firm," says Huffstedler. "Raleigh, Nashville, Boston, and Washington are all places we want to expand." As for Smith, Moore, Leatherwood, its healthcare group currently has more than 30 lawyers, according to the firm, with roughly a quarter of those based in Raleigh. Firm-wide, Smith, Moore, Leatherwood has more than 160 lawyers, according to its website. Smith, Moore, Leatherwood, and the Raleigh office in particular, has done a remarkable job of bringing in talented lawyers to continue to provide the best service we can to our valued clients, said Matt Learberg, partner in charge of the firm's Raleigh office, in an email. In just the last 18 months, the firm has added some 25 new lawyers, many of whom work right here in the Triangle, he says. Durham's Babies gets FDA approval for a device to screen infants, and that's baby spelled B-A-E-B-I-E-S. After the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's decision February 3 to allow Durham-based Babies Incorporated to market its device for screening rare disorders in newborns, the company has wasted no time readying for commercialization, according to CEO Richard West. "For us, it's about saving babies using newborn screening," says West, "and now we have a big opportunity to do that." The approval of its seeker system is babies first from the FDA. West says the company has been working on the logistics to sell and ship the product, which is expected to begin in the second quarter. He sees public health labs as potential customers in the U.S. and outside the country, both public and private labs. The seeker system is the first FDA-approved product for the screening of lysosomal storage disorders, or LSD, in newborns. The FDA says LSD can lead to organ damage and be fatal as they impact the functioning of proteins that clear certain substances from the body's cells. While West says the company with 45 employees already has a commercial team in place, he adds, "We will have a few more hires in the coming quarter or so." West and President Vamsi Pamula founded the company in 2014 following the sale of Advanced Liquid Logic to Illumina Incorporated. In 2015, Babies raised $13 million from investors. Parexel acquiring Georgia company. Parexel had announced in January that it would restructure. Parexel International Corporation has agreed to acquire the medical affairs company based in Kennesaw, Georgia. While Parexel is headquartered in Waltham, Massachusetts, Durham serves as a hub for the contract research organization. News of the acquisition follows an announcement restructuring at the beginning of January. News of the acquisition follows an announced restructuring at the beginning of January. The restructuring initiative is company-wide, Parexel stated in a filing with the SEC. These actions are expected to result in pre-tax charges in the range of $25 million to $35 million, all of which are anticipated to be cash expenditures. Of those charges, there will be $24 million to $32 million in employee separation costs, the filing further stated. In response to whether impacted positions may be in North Carolina, a spokeswoman said the company is not disclosing that information. Liquidia CEO says particle product can reduce opioid addiction. Neil Fowler, CEO of Research Triangle Park-based Liquidia Technologies, said February 2 at the NC CEO Forum that the company is using particles to aid in the fight against opioid addiction. Liquidia's particle technology for drug delivery, called PRINT, is being applied to the pain management space, among other areas. Today, there are 70 million patients in the United States who are given opioids along with surgical procedures, said Fowler, noting 10% will become addicted. But Liquidia has the ability to turn particles into longer-acting drugs. He said the company has extended the effect of the same anesthetic drug typically injected into sutures after surgery to 3 to 5 days rather than a mere 6 hours. Extending the effects of this drug will eliminate the number of patients calling their surgeons in pain after surgery, many of whom are consequently prescribed opioids, he said. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "If we don't fix health care, we don't fix the future of this country. It's that clear. Here in the state of North Carolina, healthcare spending will crowd out education, it will crowd out transportation infrastructure if it continues on the trajectory that it is on." And that is from Jack Bailey, GlaxoSmithKline's president of U.S. Pharmaceuticals, at the 2017 NC CEO Forum in Raleigh. And now we turn to the On Tech and Transportation page written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, Red Hat expands Irish operations. Red Hat has announced a 60-job, $13 million expansion in its mobile software division, but it's not happening at its Raleigh headquarters. Instead, the open-source software firm is adding jobs to its Waterford, Ireland operation, inherited in 2014 with the $82 million acquisition of Feed Henry. Michael O. Foglu, the Waterford-based chief technology officer of Red Hat Mobile, calls the deal further proof of Ireland's success when it comes to securing foreign investment, pointing to companies such as Google and Facebook as other examples. Red Hat is really taking its place among those as a big, multinational, largely American company looking to have a significant footprint in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, and Ireland is a key part of that portfolio, he says. He adds that Ireland offers a young population profile compared to some other European nations and has an English-speaking workforce. As a European Union member, Ireland doesn't have tariffs between it and other EU states. Red Hat isn't the only Triangle technology firm to seek those benefits. SAS Institute opened a new 82-employee customer contact center in Ireland in November. And Duke University spin-out Aery Pharma plans to open an Ireland manufacturing center. Red Hat's expansion comes at a time when President Donald Trump has become increasingly critical of domestic firms hiring workers overseas and he has broadly used the slogan Hire American in social media feeds. Red Hat is not concerned, Ofoglu says. This certainly isn't a divestment story at all, he explains, adding that Red Hat plans to continue to invest in U.S. research and development jobs. The story of this award predates the current administration, he says. On its website, Irish recruiting agency IDA Ireland, which is supporting the expansion, cites Ireland's 12.5% corporate tax rate for global corporations as reasons to invest. But tax advantages may not be the only incentive. Both Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst and SAS CEO Jim Goodnight have been outspoken activists on what they've referred to as the STEM gap. It's the notion that the need for science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, talent, is exceeding the supply coming out of universities in the U.S. Durham's Cree may be looking at acquisition in 2017. As Cree and Infineon prepare to close the Wolfspeed deal, execs at both companies are looking ahead to what happens next. For Durham LED maker Cree, that could mean an acquisition. If I had to guess, if things stay on the current course, we are likely to have some type of an M&A transaction in calendar 2017, Cree CEO Chuck Swoboda said on a recent earnings call. But he's careful to say it won't happen until the sale of the company's power and radio frequency division, Wolfspeed, to German semiconductor manufacturer Infineon closes. The company expects the Wolfspeed deal to generate $585 million in net profits. Add that to the $591 million in cash equivalents and short-term investments Cree had at the end of its most recently reported quarter, and its wallet will hold nearly $1.2 billion. John Quealy, a Canaccord Genuity analyst, says he doesn't believe there are any opportunities of size that Cree is missing by not shopping right now. The availability of cash will certainly dictate how sizable an acquisition could happen, he says. Angelo Zeno, an analyst at CFRA Research, says there's even a possibility that Cree itself could be a target. Once you divest Wolfspeed, you now have a company that's purely looking at the lighting business and the LED business, a company with a much better financial position, he says. Here's a look at margins for continuing operations. LED margins for the last 3 months of 2016, 29.2%. Lighting products margins for the last 3 months of 2016, 35.8%. Combined gross earnings, 32%. Cree projects Wolfspeed, now listed as a discontinued business in earnings reports, to score $55 million in revenue next quarter. Of that, it expects the unit to actually earn just $9 million in net profits. Companies say not all consumers excited about fiber. Kansas City who? It's a phrase used more than 2 years ago by Dennis Bloss, then Frontier Communications general manager, when his company first started connecting residential customers in Durham to ultra-high-speed fiber internet. He was referencing the metro where Google Fiber debuted its high-speed service in 2012. For Frontier, that Kansas City would be the Bull City. Despite announcements dating to 2014, Google Fiber didn't connect local residents to its high-speed service until 2016, and its competitors have intensified their Triangle plans. Still, not all providers have been fiber-first. Frontier, which once touted a wide rollout in Durham, now puts more energy into showcasing lower-tier offerings. Frontier spokesman Bob Ellick points out that most residential customers don't actually need the speeds fiber networks offer. Frontier's emphasis has been on pushing its Vantage TV product, which is accommodated on both the copper and the fiber network. Fiber implementation is a costly, complex process, and not every company can bankroll a wide launch, noted Blair Levin, former executive director of the National Broadband Plan. That's especially true when customer adoption rates at lower speeds prove sufficient. Time Warner Cable, for example, is among the larger providers in the Triangle, even though it does not offer a residential fiber option. Patrick Paterno, a Charter communications spokesman, says Charter's $65 million TWC Internet Ultimate easily meets streaming video needs in Raleigh with top download speeds of 300 megabits per second. Frontier's Alex said new speed capabilities on copper have lessened the need for fiber-based services. For most average users, even 100 Mbps is overkill, so gigabit service, while possible, is not always a practical or necessary consideration for most, he wrote. But as Levin points out, internet speeds across the spectrum tend to get faster when Google Fiber debuts. AT&T, for example, says its top-tier fiber service is now available to more than 200,000 living units in the Triangle and is expanding across the state. AT&T spokesman Josh Galena said in metros where AT&T offers its 100% fiber network, it finds a higher percentage of customers are subscribing to its internet service compared to metros where it has yet to upgrade its speeds. In fiber metros, such as the Triangle, about 30% of its new internet customers are subscribing to AT&T's highest tier AT&T Internet 1000 plan. Outer Banks homeowners sue NCDOT to stop plans to build $145 million Rodanthe Bridge. A group of homeowners along the Outer Banks filed a federal lawsuit this month in hopes of halting plans for a 2.4-mile bridge near Rodanthe. The group called Save Our Sound OBX is led by plaintiff Mark Haynes. He accuses the North Carolina Department of Transportation of failing to consider all environmental implications when picking the location for the Rodanthe Bridge. Haynes lives in Cincinnati but owns two rental properties near the project. "We think there are better options than the bridge," he says, pointing to beach nourishment and highway relocation alternatives. "They could just move the road further west and not even have to build a bridge." In the lawsuit, the homeowners called the decision to approve the bridge unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious, and asked that it be vacated by the court. Haynes calls the bridge site one of the better kiteboarding locations on the Outer Banks and says it's the whole reason his rental properties secure business. With construction set to happen 30 yards out the front door, he worries the value potential of his homes will be diminished. NCDOT and the Federal Highway Administration are both named in the suit, as are NCDOT Secretary James Trognan and John Sullivan, Division Administrator of FHA. NCDOT recently approved a $145 million bid for the project, which could begin in 2018. As it stands now, the bridge will extend from the southern end of the Pea Island National Wildlife Refuge over the Pamlico Sound into Rodanthe. And in a section called Top Flights, RDU passengers love Boston. RDU Durham International Airport's record year had help from Boston. According to data from RDU, Boston's Logan Airport was the number one destination out of RDU in 2016. Here are the top 10 destinations out of the airport ranked by passengers per day each way, according to RDU officials. Number 1, Boston, 668. 2, New York's LaGuardia, 576. 3, Atlanta, 449. 4, Chicago, 471. Orlando, 411. New York's JFK, 388. Denver, 363. Los Angeles, 338. Newark, 322, and Philadelphia, 318. And finally, in a section called They Said It, the first quote, "The brand has been around for 22 years, and it really gets its roots in the scientific area, but we're really branching out." That's from Robert Bonavito, CEO of Morrisville's Jaeger. on why, Yeager, on why his company changed its name and brand identity from SideQuest. Severe flooding led to some disruptions, resulting in abnormal operating costs of $12.1 million. But I'm proud to say that due to the extraordinary efforts from our team, we did not miss a single delivery to Airbus during that period. That's from Thomas Gentile, CEO of Spirit AeroSystems, on how aircraft parts manufacturer's Kinston operation has been negatively impacted by Hurricane Matthew, which struck in October. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column, Reading Program Aids Low-Income Kids. Early in 2016, a coalition of 31 groups in Wake County staged its third annual book drive and collected 115,000 books. Known as Wake Up and Read, the coalition last spring hosted literacy nights for children and parents at 10 elementary schools, with Wake's highest percentage of low-income students receiving lunch for free or at a discounted price, and at 20 nearby child care centers whose children go on to those schools, as well as 9 community centers. The focus of the literacy nights was the importance of helping kids continue to learn during the summer to improve their reading and avoid an erosion of academic process they make during the previous school year. The week after the literacy nights, all the children received 10 books to keep, with their parents reading one book to the children each week over the summer. Children who are behind get more behind, and so it's very difficult to catch up, says Lisa Finaldi, community engagement leader at the North Carolina Early Childhood Foundation. For the next 3 years, the Early Childhood Foundation will be working with Wake Up and Read and separate coalitions in Chatham, Durham, Johnston, and Orange counties that aim to help improve reading proficiency among targeted low-income children so they can read at grade level by the end of third grade. In those counties, less than 40% of economically disadvantaged students read at grade level by the end of third grade last year, compared to nearly 58% of all students. The new effort is being funded over 3 years with an initial investment of $700,000, including $625,000 from the Triangle Community Foundation and at least $25,000 from the United Way of the Greater Triangle. Triangle Community Foundation has agreed to give $50,000 per year to each coalition in Wake, Durham, Chatham, and Orange counties, and $25,000 the first year to the Early Childhood Foundation. The United Way is giving $25,000 over 2 years to the Early Childhood Foundation and will fund the Johnston County Initiative, although the amount has not been determined, Finaldi says. Also in Wake County, corporate partners include PNC Bank, Fidelity, and Eaton Corporation, which provide warehouse space for donated books. The Early Childhood Foundation is the lead agency in North Carolina for the Campaign for Grade Level Reading, a national effort to improve reading proficiency among low-income students by the end of third grade. Research shows that improving reading proficiency also depends on improving school attendance and making sure children arrive at kindergarten with the social, emotional, and developmental skills to learn, Finaldi says. The two funders of the new Triangle Initiative aim to raise more money to invest in local partnerships over the long term, she says. You have to have a coalition, she adds. Schools or parents cannot solve this problem alone. And now we'll read the nonprofit news. Adoption group gets lift. The Duke Endowment has announced a 4-year, $3.7 million grant to expand foster care and prevention services across the state, the Children's Home Society of North Carolina announced. The Greensboro-based group serves more than 20,000 children and families. A child without a family is unacceptable, said Brian Maness, president and CEO of Children's Home Society of North Carolina. Boost for Wake County Schools. The Wake Education Partnership, a nonprofit organization committed to improving public education in the Wake County public school system, is receiving a $35,000 grant from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. The Wake Ed Partnership, founded in 1983 by local business leaders, will use the funding to support programming in the Wake County public school system. Steve Parrott, president of the Wake Ed Partnership, said, "We are extremely grateful for their investment in the community." Walmart provides funding. The Walmart Foundation is inviting local nonprofits with hunger relief programs to apply for grants between $25,000 and $200,000. The foundation began accepting grant applications on February 6 with a deadline of midnight February 10. We see these grants as opportunities to use our size and strengths to help others, said Cade Mora, Regional General Manager for Walmart. Supporting local hunger relief programs is one more way we can help children and families have access to nutritious food. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can from the Viewpoint page. The column on this Viewpoint is written by Andy Ellen and Gary Harris. Andy Ellen is President and General Counsel of the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association, and Gary Harris is the Executive Director of the North Carolina Petroleum and Convenience Marketers. The headline on their Viewpoint column, Repealing Durbin Rule Will Hurt Small Retailers. Every retailer and restaurant in the Triangle, in fact across the country, faces a giant problem and it could soon get worse. Every time you swipe your credit card to pay for groceries, gas, or dinner, the bank that issued your card charges as much as a 500% markup to the merchant for processing that purchase. Meanwhile, credit card companies are offering consumers frequent flyer points and cashback rewards on credit card purchases because they don't pay for it. They use the money from swipe fees to fund these programs. It is always easy to give away someone else's money. Simply put, Visa and MasterCard dominate the credit card market, creating a monopoly and dodging competition, the complete opposite of the free market principles that built the largest economy in the world. They don't have to compete with other banks. Why should you care? Because retailers, your grocer or the corner gas station or the guy who sells you shoes, are in a highly competitive business. So their profit margins must be razor thin to keep customers from deserting to the store down the street. When banks charge merchants these outrageous swipe fees, merchants have to raise prices to at least partially offset the fees or risk going out of business. Things are a little better with debit cards because 6 years ago Congress tried to help consumers by bringing more competition to that corner of the card market. Under reform, the Durbin Amendment to the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Law, Congress required that merchants have a choice of two unaffiliated companies to process their debit card transactions. Before reform, the banks, Visa and MasterCard, had tried to squash these competitors and keep the lucrative business to themselves. Reform also limited how high Visa and MasterCard... Oh, and actually, we'll have to stop there. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.